My husband was horrified. He did not reproach Carl, but he practically stopped talking to him right up to the day of his departure. Carl went to war without a single word from his father. During his training, he sent us snapshots, but my husband always pushed the photos aside. He did not want to look at his son in an SS uniform. Once I told him, "We have to live with Hitler, like millions of others. You know what the neighbors think of us. You will have difficulties at the factory." He only answered, "I simply can't pretend. They have even taken our son away from us." He said the same thing when Carl left us. He seemed to have written Carl off as his son.
I listened intently to the woman, and I nodded occasionally to encourage her to continue. She could not tell me enough. I had previously talked to many Germans and Austrians, and learned from them how National Socialism had affected them. Most said they had been against it, but were frightened of their neighbors, and their neighbors had likewise been frightened of them. When one added together all these fears, the result was a frightful accumulation of mistrust. There were many people like Carl's parents, but what about the people who did not need to knuckle under because they had readily accepted the new regime? National Socialism was for them the fulfillment of their dearest wishes. It lifted them out of their insignificance. That it should come to power at the expense of innocent victims did not worry them. They were in the winners' camp, and they severed relations with the losers. They expressed the contempt of the strong for the weak, the Superman's scorn for the subhuman. I looked at the old lady, who was clearly kind-hearted, a good mother and a good wife. Without doubt, she must often have shown sympathy for the oppressed, but the happiness of her own family was of paramount importance to her. There were millions of such families, anxious only for peace and quiet in their own little nests. These were the mounting blocks by which the criminals climbed to power and kept it. Should I now tell the old lady the naked truth? Should I tell her what her good boy had done in the name of his leaders? What link was there between me, who might have been among her son's victims, and her, a lonely woman grieving for the ruin of her family amid the ruins of her people? I saw her grief, and I knew my own grief. Was sorrow our common link? Was it possible for grief to be an affinity? I did not know the answers to these questions. Suddenly the woman resumed her recollections.
One day, they fetched the Jews away. Among them was our family doctor. According to the propaganda, the Jews were to be resettled. It was said that Hitler was giving them a whole province in which they could live undisturbed among their own people. But later I heard of the brutality with which the SS treated them. My son was in Poland at the time, and people talked of the awful things that were happening there. One day my husband said, "Carl is with the SS over there. Perhaps the positions are reversed, and he is now treating our doctor, who formerly treated him." My husband would not say what he meant by that, but I knew he was upset. I was very depressed.
Suddenly the old lady looked at me intently.
"You are not a German?"
she ventured. "No," I replied. "I am a Jew." She became a little embarrassed. At that time, all Germans were embarrassed when they met Jews. She hastened to tell me,
"In this district, we always lived with the Jews in a very peaceful fashion. We are not responsible for their fate."
"Yes," said I, "that is what they all say now, and I can well believe it of you, but there are others from whom I won't take it. The question of Germany's guilt may never be settled. But one thing is certain, no German can shrug off the responsibility. Even if he has no personal guilt, he must share the shame of it. As a member of a guilty nation, he cannot simply walk away like a passenger leaving a tram car whenever he chooses. It is the duty of Germans to find out who was guilty. And the non-guilty must dissociate themselves publicly from the guilty." I felt I had spoken sharply. The lonely widow looked at me sadly. She was not the person with whom one could debate about the sins and the guilt of the Germans. This broken woman, so deeply immersed in grief, was no recipient for my reproaches. I was sorry for her. Perhaps I should not have raised the issue of guilt.
"I can't really believe the stories that they tell," she went on. "I can't believe what they say happened to the Jews. During the war, there were so many different stories. My husband was the only person who seemed to have known the truth. Some of his workmen had been out east setting up machinery, and when they came back, they told of things even my husband would not believe, although he knew that the party was capable of anything. He did not tell me much of what he had heard. Probably he was afraid I might gossip unthinkingly, and then we get into trouble with the Gestapo, who were already ill-disposed toward us and kept a watchful eye on my husband. But as our Karl was with the SS, they did not molest us. Some of our friends and acquaintances got into trouble. They had been denounced by their best friends. My husband told me once that a Gestapo official had been to see him at the works, where foreigners were employed. He was inquiring into a case of sabotage. He talked to my husband for a long time, and finally said, 'You are above suspicion, for your son is with the SS.' When Father came home and told me what had happened, he said bitterly, 'They have turned the world upside down. The one thing that has hurt me more than anything else in my life is now my protection.' He simply could not understand it."
I gazed at the lonely woman sitting sadly with her memories. I formed a picture of how she lived. I knew that from time to time she would take in her arms her son's bundle, his last present, as if it were her son himself.
"I can well believe what people said. So many dreadful things happened, but one thing is certain. Karl never did any wrong. He was always a decent young man. I miss him so much now that my husband is dead."
I thought of the many mothers who were also bereft of their sons. But her son had not lied to me. His home was just as he had described it. Yet the solution of my problem was not a single step nearer. I took my leave without diminishing in any way the poor woman's last surviving consolation, faith in the goodness of her son. Perhaps it was a mistake not to have told her the truth. Perhaps her tears might help to wash away some of the misery of the world. That was not the only thought that occurred to me. I knew there was little I could say to this mother, and whatever I might have told her about her son's crime, she would not have believed. She would prefer to think of me as a slanderer than acknowledge Karl's crime. She kept repeating the words, "He was such a good boy," as if she wished me to confirm it, but that I could not do. Would she still have the same opinion of him if she knew all? In his boyhood, Karl had certainly been a good boy, but a graceless period of his life had turned him into a murderer. My picture of Karl was almost complete. His physical likeness was now established, for in his mother's home I had at last seen his face. I knew all about his childhood, and I knew all about the crime he had committed, and was pleased with myself for not having told his mother of his wicked deed. I convinced myself that I had acted rightly. In her present circumstances, to take from her her last possession would probably also have been a crime. Today, I sometimes think of the young SS man. Every time I enter a hospital, every time I see a nurse or a man with his head bandaged, I recall him. Or, when I see a sunflower. And I reflect that people like him are still being born, people who can be indoctrinated with evil. Mankind is ostensibly striving to avert catastrophes. Medical progress gives us hope that one day disease can be conquered. But will we ever be able to prevent the creation of mass murderers? The work in which I am engaged brings me into contact with many known murderers. I hunt them out, I hear witnesses, I give evidence in courts, and I see how murderers behave when accused. At the trial of Nazis in Stuttgart, only one of the accused showed remorse. He actually confessed to deeds of which there were not witnesses, All the others bitterly disputed the truth. Many of them regretted only one thing, that witnesses had survived to tell the truth. I have often tried to imagine how that young SS man would have behaved if he had been put on trial 25 years later. Would he have spoken in court as he did to me before he died in the dean's room? Would he openly admit what he had confessed to me on his deathbed? Perhaps the picture that I had formed of him in my mind was kinder than the reality. I never saw him in the camp with a whip in his hand. I saw him only on his deathbed, a man who wanted absolution for his crime. Was he thus an exception? I could find no answer to that question. How could I know if he would have committed further crimes had he survived? I have a fairly detailed knowledge of the life story of many Nazi murderers. Few of them were born murderers. They had mostly been peasants, manual laborers, clerks, or officials, such as one meets in normal everyday life. In their youth, they had received religious instruction, and none had a previous criminal record. Yet they became murderers, expert murderers by conviction. It was as if they had taken down their SS uniforms from the wardrobe and replaced them with their consciences, as well as with their civilian clothes. I couldn't possibly know their reactions to their first crimes, but I do know that every one of them had subsequently murdered on a wholesale scale. When I recall the insolent replies and the mocking grins of many of these accused, it is difficult for me to believe that my repentant young SS man would also have behaved in that way. Yet, ought I to have forgiven him? Today the world demands that we forgive and forget the heinous crimes committed against us. It urges that we draw a line and close the account as if nothing had ever happened. We who suffered in those dreadful days, we who cannot obliterate the hell we endured, are forever being advised to keep silent. Well, I kept silent when a young Nazi, on his deathbed, begged me to be his confessor. And later, when I met his mother, I again kept silent, rather than shatter her illusions about her dead son's inherent goodness. And how many bystanders kept silent as they watched Jewish men, women, and children being led to the slaughterhouses of Europe? There are many kinds of silence. Indeed, it can be more eloquent than words, and it can be interpreted in many ways. Was my silence at the bedside of the dying Nazi right or wrong? This is a profound moral question that challenges the conscience of the reader of this episode just as much as it once challenged my heart and my mind. There are those who can appreciate my dilemma and so endorse my attitude, and there are others who will be ready to condemn me for refusing to ease the last moment of a repentant murderer. The crux of the matter is, of course, the question of forgiveness. Forgetting is something that time alone takes care of, but forgiveness is an act of volition, and only the sufferer is qualified to make the decision. You, who have just read this sad and tragic episode in my life, can mentally change places with me and ask yourself the crucial question, what would I have done? Book 2, The Symposium. Sven Alkali. On reading The Sunflower, I was greatly interested in and also moved by the events described in the book. Writing as a Bosnian and a Jew, I can state that I now find myself confronted with the same question and dilemma posed by The Sunflower. After World War II and the Nuremberg trials, we assumed that what happened to the Jews of Europe would not happen ever again. Never again. Again has happened, in the very heart of Europe. Events in Bosnia and Herzegovina during the last 3.5 years, which have some parallels with the Holocaust, can inform the search for an answer to the question of forgiveness. I do not in any way wish to compare the genocide in Bosnia and Herzegovina with the Holocaust, or to suggest that they are identical. I do wish to state, however, that clear parallels exist in regard to the worth of human life. In Sarajevo, we were forced to live like rats, scavenging for food. Our only access to the outside world ran through a dark and muddy, 160 by 180 centimeter tunnel. Even our president had to endure this life-threatening trek. We were forced to live in fear that we would not see tomorrow, knowing that we could be the next victims of the best-planned, indiscriminate shelling campaign in history. We were forced to endure this hell of a life for almost 4 years, and now we take pride in having survived the longest siege in the history of modern warfare. We saw the slaughter of Srebrenica, where 8,000 innocents were killed while under the protection of the United Nations. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, we've seen entire families perish, children deliberately killed, tortured, and raped, and we've seen rape become a tool of war. Over 10,000 individuals, including 1,700 children, were killed in Sarajevo alone, over 200,000 people throughout the country. Now their final resting places can be found throughout the city, in its former parks, playgrounds, and backyards. This Bosnian generation, as well as the generation that lived through the Holocaust, are among the only ones who have the right to give an answer to the question of forgiveness. Indeed, to paraphrase a colleague of Simon's, nobody who hasn't bodily gone through what we went through will ever be able to understand fully. If this may seem tangential to the theme of forgiveness, I can assure you that it is not. Although Simon was unsure whether his response to the dying SS man was correct, there was no question as to whether or not he should forget the crimes. It was the images of Eli and the figure of the repentant murderer that remained with Simon. Forgetting the crimes would be worse than forgiving the criminal who seeks forgiveness, because forgetting the crimes devalues the humanity that perished in these atrocities. And, as is correctly pointed out by Simon's colleagues, he had no right to forgive on behalf of the victims. This is where the issues of collective or individual guilt and victimhood must come into play. Can we, ought we, forgive murderers who are still alive? It is also a question of how much, how quickly, how easily can any individual forgive a mass murderer? Who is entitled to speak on behalf of the victims, and must one forget before one can forgive? Can I forgive a Serb nationalist gunner who, his breath reeking of plum brandy, lobbed shells into queues of people waiting for bread and water? Or can I forgive the thug who smoked cigarettes and drank alcohol while waiting for a mother or a father, a brother, a sister, a son or a daughter to emerge into his sniper's sight? The simple answer in this context is no. But that is not the dilemma faced by Simon. His dilemma comes not only because the dying SS man asks for forgiveness, but also because he genuinely seems to recognize his crime and guilt. This recognition, if nothing else, is an important first step. The question of forgiveness must be defined in individual or collective terms, just as guilt must be defined in individual or collective terms. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, the Serb fanatical leadership has fed its population such venomous propaganda that some innocent Serbs do not know what happened in the past 4 years. Others do know, but, like the father of Karl, felt that they could not act outside the bounds of the mob mentality that swept over much of the victimizer population, both in Nazi Germany and in Serb-occupied Bosnia and Herzegovina. Therefore, at this time, there is no general accounting of what actually happened among some Serb and even Croat people, as was the case with Karl's mother. But without recognition of what happened, there can never be forgiveness. That is exactly why today's war crimes tribunal is so important. Not only will it dispense justice by punishing the guilty, but also it will show what happened during the past 4 years, and would even eventually absolve the innocent. That way, the groundwork for reconciliation would be possible. Simon's question is not about reconciliation, but rather forgiveness. Nevertheless, you cannot have forgiveness without reconciliation, and you cannot have reconciliation without at least a shred of forgiveness. This forgiveness is not for those who killed or who orchestrated mass murder and on their deathbed seek to put their minds at ease, but for those who truly feel a collective guilt for the heinous crimes their ethnic, political, religious brothers committed in the name of that brotherhood. As Simon told the mother of the dying SS man, even if a member of a society did not take part in the crimes, he or she must at least share the shame of the crimes. I explicitly and emphatically reject the idea of collective guilt, but I do believe that there is such a thing as national or state responsibility for genocide, for mass murder, and for drumming up an artificial hatred among the ordinary people, by various means, to make that genocide easier to carry out. It cannot be stressed enough that the punishment of the guilty and some measure of justice are absolutely necessary for forgiveness or reconciliation even to be considered. If genocide goes unpunished, it will set a precedent for tomorrow's genocide. Without justice, there can never be reconciliation and real peace. But when speaking of crimes against international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions and the Genocide Convention, the very instruments of international law based on and built upon the ashes of the Holocaust, we must remember that each crime against international law is a crime against humanity, and not only against the person or society targeted for extinction. That is the whole point of international law, and we must also remember that each and every victim is one of the collective us, whether they be Jews in Europe of the 1940s or Muslims in Europe of the 1990s. As to the original question, I myself and the other readers will have to answer for themselves. I can say, however, that an argument can be made to forgive if there is a genuine recognition of guilt. But I cannot stress enough that to forget is unthinkable, both when discussing the Holocaust and Bosnia. In the end, reconciliation must be the end goal for a return to the inherent beauty of living. Thus, at the threshold of the 21st century, what have we gained from our experiences with man's inhumanity toward man? Apparently not that much. After knowing what we knew about the Holocaust, the genocide of Bosnia and Herzegovina should shame us all. Of course, that shame would not bring back life to the dead of Auschwitz or Treblinka, Sarajevo or Srebrenica, but that shame does make it incumbent upon us to hold accountable those who arrogantly and immorally valued their lives so much more over those of their fellow men and women. Jean Emery, my high regard for your activities over the past 2 decades, activities that you pursued irrespective of the dangers they entailed for you personally, obliges me to comply immediately with your request to comment on the problems raised in your story, The Sunflower. An SS man who took part in the extermination was dying. On his deathbed, he was plagued by his Christian conscience, which had persisted through the SS training, and with his final breaths, he asks for absolution, forgiveness by a Jew. You yourself, a concentration camp inmate at the time, surrounded by the 1,000 faces of death that assailed your brothers and continually threatened you, did not want to grant the dying man the words of forgiveness he sought so ardently, with clasped hands even. You left him without absolution. He died without consolation. That seems to haunt you. In any case, it preoccupies you. Quite rightly, you challenge the opinions of your contemporaries, those who have suffered with you, and those whom you regard, for various reasons, as moral authorities. As for me, I am one of those who, like yourself, escaped that giant dragnet only by chance, a survivor. Not a moral authority, to be sure. My opinion is a private one, concerning only myself, and is of no public importance whatsoever. That allows me a great deal of freedom. I can speak without fear that my words could become behavioral maxims for anyone else, regardless of the small extent to which this may apply. Dear Mr. Wiesenthal, you will inevitably be disappointed by my comments. Your problem is not a problem for me. Let me explain. You did not give the dying SS man absolution from a Jew. If I had been in such a situation, perhaps I would have been more yielding. Both your intransigence and my magnanimity, which is possible but by no means certain, mean nothing to me, or rather would mean nothing to me. As I see it, The issue of forgiving or not forgiving in such a case has only two aspects, a psychological one and a political one. Psychologically, forgiving or not forgiving in this specific case is nothing more than a question of temperament or feeling. I do not want to impute any other possible behavior to you, but I can easily imagine that, under only slightly different circumstances, you might have forgiven the dying man. Suppose you had seen his pleading and imploring eyes, which may have had more of an effect on you than his rasping voice and folded hands. Or suppose that just before that encounter you had been in contact with one of those decent SS men, whom we all knew, who had treated you with a little bit of kindness, putting you in a more tolerant mood. Or suppose you learned that some German had helped a close relative to escape. As you know better than I, such things really did happen. So, then you might have forgiven. In my view, it would have meant just as little as your, or possibly my, refusal. So much for the psychological perspective. Now, the political. Here, too, in such a dramatically critical but certainly unique case, and therefore without any general implications, forgiving or not forgiving is quite irrelevant. Whether you are an agnostic or a believer, I do not know, but your problem belongs to the realm of guilt and atonement. So, even if we cast it in an agnostic form, the problem is a theological one, and as such, it does not exist for me, an atheist who is indifferent to and rejecting of any metaphysics of morality. I think that this does not concern individual forgiveness or individual intransigence. One can say, your dying SS man took part in the extermination. He knew very well what he was doing. He may come to terms with his God, if he believes in one, and may just as well die unconsoled. One can also say, what difference does it make? Let him rest in peace, in the name of God or of the devil, and if my forgiveness matters to him, I'll give it. Politically, it does not make any difference. Since I see the whole question only in political terms and can deal with the problem of forgiveness from this perspective only, I must abstain from approving or condemning your behavior. The axiomatic theory of my political thought may be rooted in morality, but this is not at issue here and would lead us too far astray. Don't think, however, that I wish to make light of the issue or avoid painful questions by shifting to the political terrain and necessarily leaving the problematic base of your story behind. Politically, I do not want to hear anything of forgiveness. I believe that you, who have devoted your life to investigating the political realm of Nazi crimes, will understand my position. Why does it matter to me? For one simple reason. What you and I went through must not happen again, never, nowhere. Therefore, and I have said and written this over and over, I refuse any reconciliation with the criminals, and with those who only by accident did not happen to commit atrocities, and finally, all those who helped prepare the unspeakable acts with their words. Only if Nazi crimes like the genocide of European Jewry are not subject to a statute of limitations now or in the future. Only if everyone who committed atrocities is hunted down and finally caught will the potential murderers of tomorrow and the day after tomorrow be prevented from realizing their criminal potential. I agree with your point in your remarkable article in Le Monde that too many criminals are spared by the letter of the law, that too many of the murderers in uniform, too many bloody judges of yesterday, are spending their last years in peace. Your cause, if I understand you correctly, was always a political one. Just as I leave the angels and sparrows to heaven, so I leave the moral-theological, moral-philosophical question of the answer, and just between us, there will never be one, in the hands of the licensed professionals, that is, the speculation of tenured university professors. Don't trouble yourself, Mr. Wiesenthal. You didn't forgive, and it was certainly your right. And if you had said words of forgiveness in a fit of emotion, that would have been legitimate, too. Your SS man was a devil, perhaps a poor devil. He and his death don't matter, just as the response of inmate Wiesenthal doesn't matter. What does matter is the activity of the director and founder of the Documentation Center. He has nothing to do with that criminal who died in the field hospital, but with others who live here among us, and live better than many of our old companions. The director of the Documentation Center should not allow them to live this sweet life, but rather make sure that the arm of worldly justice, weak and ineffectual as it is, still reaches them. This is what I'm hoping for. Thankful for your work, and with friendly greetings. Smail Balich. Now that 30 years have passed since The Sunflower was written, we can regard the horrifying events of this autobiographical story with some degree of detachment. This detachment allows for a more sober assessment of the issues the story raises concerning remorse and forgiveness. At the time of those dramatic events, the author was himself persecuted, his very existence threatened by the destructive machinery of a gruesome regime. When an SS man, plagued by a bad conscience, begged him for forgiveness, he saw no choice but to refuse. Most likely, I would have done the same in his situation. However, many people would argue that the dying man's sincere remorse and fervent desire invited the opposite reaction, especially if one had not suffered any direct personal harm from the pleading man. The author, Simon Wiesenthal, would not have cheapened himself by granting formal forgiveness, although it would have cost him a great deal of effort. In this situation, forgiveness would have been only on his personal behalf, thus ruling out the notion of general absolution anyway. Still, it would have accomplished its purpose. I personally feel bound by tradition to summon up some compassion, merhamet, as Bosnians call it, for every sufferer. This desire is, of course, purely theoretical. Nonetheless, in order to understand a person who has carried the burden of so much injustice and suffering, we have to imagine ourselves in his position. In the words of an Oriental fable, no doctor should go to a person who has fallen from a minaret if he has not experienced this type of fall himself. A great deal of circumspection would be required before pronouncing judgment here. In any case, we may view the belated remorse of the young SS man of this story as a sign of hope and a signal of a new democratic beginning for Germany. Shortly after this time, Germany evolved into a stalwart supporter and friend of the Jews. By confessing and showing his remorse, the dying man testifies to his awareness of the gravity of his crimes. Thus, for whatever time might remain to him, he would be a changed man. In religious terms, this decisive change in his life would be called a conversion. Of course, every person is responsible for his or her actions, and no one is able to absolve the guilt that one person bears toward others. No soul carries the burden of another. There is no such thing as collective guilt, since collective guilt would point fingers at the innocent as well as the guilty. We may only properly speak of general culpability if a society tolerates the development of a fundamentally perverted image of man. Rectifying a misdeed is a matter to be settled between the perpetrator and the victim. A third party has no proper role other than mediator. Evil cannot be offset by good when there is no genuine remorse. There are crimes whose enormity cannot be measured. In the view of believers, only God, in his infinite mercy, can cleanse the sins of the perpetrators of these crimes. The Sunflower broaches many other questions of crime and punishment. One of the story's central concerns is the impassive societal reaction to the transgression. Those who might appear uninvolved in the actual crimes, but who tolerate acts of torture, humiliation, and murder, are certainly also guilty. Looking away may be a comfortable but ultimately disastrous path, the effects of which are incalculable. The story also examines historically embedded prejudices, clichés, and stereotypes that shape the views of the masses. One of the imperative tasks of education is to come to terms with this legacy. By pinpointing mankind's failings and woes, Wiesenthal's The Sunflower proves a good guide. Moshe Beisky. The subject which I was asked to relate to is complex and complicated, not only because it involves issues of conscience, morality, psychology, religion, and belief, but also because the dilemma focuses on two individuals who met under abnormal circumstances and conditions, and who ostensibly behaved and reacted in a quasi-rational manner based on the appropriate ethical considerations of human beings created in the image of God. What is more, I was asked to relate to these events 50 years after they took place. Can considerations and behaviors be analyzed after so many years and under conditions of peace and well-being, which include the ability to overcome the spontaneous emotions caused by unexpected events? Or perhaps the distance of time and different conditions makes it difficult, if not impossible, to examine what the appropriate behavior should have been, given the emotional state, the severe mental pressure, and the circumstances, which cannot be reproduced because they have never existed before and because the human mind has never invented anything like them. Indeed, the Nazi, the SS man Karl, is a human being who was severely injured and in the throes of death. As such, and according to rational criteria, he may be worthy not only of sympathy and understanding for his suffering and his condition, but also of pardon and forgiveness for past crimes because he had confessed to them, assuming that the confession was not just formal, but based on true remorse emanating from pangs of conscience. Yet, for Wiesenthal and others who lived under the same circumstances, Karl was a representative of German Nazism, or at least typical of the hundreds of thousands of SS troops and Sonderkommando who had joined up voluntarily and were fully aware of what they were doing. Together with others, they not only routinely committed the most abominable crimes of oppression, starvation, humiliation, and forced hard labor to the point of death against the Jewish population, but were also involved in mass exterminations, using methods that no human mind had thought of up to that time. Only the awareness of imminent and certain death induced Karl to think that his actions had been crimes against both humanity and God. Had he not been mortally wounded, he would almost certainly have continued to commit these crimes, along with his comrades, who had volunteered for these assignments of their own free will and in large numbers, never regretting their actions, but rather justifying them by claiming that they had only been carrying out orders. At the time of this incident, Wiesenthal is only an individual, a prisoner in a camp where he is being terrorized, worked to death, starved, and humiliated. His entire family has already been annihilated in Belzec or Treblinka, and he knows that his death is certain, in another hour, another day, or another week. He, Wiesenthal, was also a witness. With his own eyes, he had seen the mass shootings of naked people beside the death pits, the public hangings on the gallows. He had watched so many people die. He had seen all his relatives and fellow townspeople murdered. In this respect, he is a representative witness for all those who lived or were no longer alive then, and as long as the atrocities continued, he certainly could not free himself of the revulsion and deep anguish he felt toward the actions of the SS man Karl and all his comrades who continued to commit these crimes. In his confession, Karl described a mother and father who jumped together with their children from a building which had been set on fire by the Nazi troops, and Wiesenthal was reminded of the child, Eli, from the Lvov ghetto, who he had known well and cared for until he disappeared. There are only two people in the death chamber, but each one represents an entirely different world. One, all the evil and the horrible crimes that, up till the moment he was wounded, he himself perpetrated, and his comrades and the regime he is a part of continue to perpetrate against human beings, and the other, the emotionally and physically broken victim of those crimes, whose pain is too much to bear because of what they have done to him, his family, and his people. Whose forgiveness was being sought? That of a Jew, whose fate had already been sealed by the dying man's comrades, who did not then feel, and most likely never felt, remorse. I never had an encounter with a dying SS man, as Wiesenthal unwittingly did, but I shared his experiences in all other respects. My family was also deported to Belzec, along with all the other residents of my town. I endured all the hellish nightmare of the war years in forced labor camps, in concentration and extermination camps. I saw so much death, so many executions. I was starved to death, I was degraded, made to feel subhuman, and I have forgotten none of the atrocities carried out against the Jews by the Nazi regime. I am afraid that anyone who has been there and experienced it all would not have behaved any differently than Wiesenthal did then, and not only because the circumstances prevented him from thinking and reacting in a rational and deliberate manner, based on moral, religious, humanitarian, or philosophical considerations. But how can forgiveness be asked of someone whose death sentence will soon be carried out by the dying man's partners in crime, who are part of the same regime, when the dying person himself admits that he too has been committing these same crimes against the Jewish people and was only stopped when the hand of God overtook him? Even if Wiesenthal believed that he was empowered to grant a pardon in the name of the murdered masses, such an act of mercy would have been a kind of betrayal and repudiation of the memory of millions of innocent victims who were unjustly murdered, among them the members of his family. Although Wiesenthal's reaction was instinctive and dictated by the deep suffering he was feeling for what he, his family, and an entire people had undergone, I doubt whether religious ethics, Jewish or Christian, or an altruistic conscience could lead to a level of self-sacrificing mercy beyond the ability of a human being, with the exception of saints and clergymen who act in the name of God. In fact, religious belief had declined a great deal in the face of God's silence. A very observant relative of mine, who had been preparing himself for the rabbinate before the war, was with me in the Plaszów camp. On the day of the selection in May 1944, when the last 280 children remaining in the camp were deported to Auschwitz, together with the old people and the sick, my cousin said, "I don't believe in God anymore." Till the day he died, he never regained his faith. Forgiveness could not be granted in the name of God, either. At a certain point during my testimony at the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, when I stood face to face with the embodiment of evil, I told the judges that I doubted whether the fear, pain, helplessness, depression, and hopelessness which we felt then could be reproduced now at a distance of so many years. This is certainly true with respect to the dilemma in question. Nevertheless, I exhorted myself to be faithful only to considerations, feelings, and behaviors that relate to the circumstances and conditions that existed then. In this way, I was able to arrive at the above conclusion. We can only be thankful that the passage of time dulls the pain somewhat and heals the open wounds to a certain extent, so that we can look at the issues in a broader perspective. Yet the crimes committed by the Nazi regime were so barbarous and so destructive to the victims that those who somehow managed to survive have never been able to free themselves of the horrors they had to endure. Moreover, the few survivors found themselves with no families, and their children grew up without grandparents. Thus, in addition to all their other injustices, the Nazis themselves have prevented their crimes from being forgotten. The survivors have been sentenced to bear their pain and sadness to the grave. Without forgetting, there can be no forgiving. It is indeed true that not only the German people are interested in consigning the crimes of the Nazi regime to oblivion, the world has also begun to forget too soon. Even in the countries that suffered under the occupation of that sadistic regime, the number of Nazi criminals who have been found, brought to trial, and punished, even as a deterrent for potential criminals, is dwindling. Thus, thousands and perhaps hundreds of thousands of Germans who participated in and committed genocide and crimes against humanity returned to their homes and to quiet, peaceful lives without their consciences ever bothering them, without ever feeling any remorse. Certainly, these people do not need to be forgiven by anyone, not by the victims and not by God. Does repentance alone justify and bring about forgiveness and allow crimes to be forgotten? Even in normal criminology and penology, only true regret accompanied by reformed behavior can be considered a justification for lightening a sentence, and even then, not necessarily in the case of serious crimes. No matter what, regret never pardons crimes, except when the state declares an amnesty for certain crimes, generally for political reasons. We all remember the heated debate during the 1960s over the issue of establishing a statute of limitations for prosecuting Nazi criminals for the crime of genocide and crimes against humanity. At the time, the opinion was that, since the crimes in question were so terrible that humanity has never known anything like them before, there was no justification for putting a time limit on their prosecution, allowing the passage of time to atone for crimes which cannot be forgiven. Another point about Wiesenthal's behavior, also in hindsight. I have already said that, by leaving the room after hearing Karl's confession, or more correctly, statement, Wiesenthal behaved in the only way he could have behaved, according to the reasonable feelings of an individual in his situation. He had no desire for revenge toward the person who had injured him and his people so cruelly, nor did he feel any satisfaction about the circumstances. He went out of his way to visit Karl's mother, but refrained from telling her the truth about the crimes her son committed while he served in the SS, if only to help her preserve her image of a son she remembered as a good boy. It seems to me that this restraint goes beyond what a human being could be expected to do. Even considering the distance in time and the use of hindsight, I am certain that Wiesenthal's conscience should not be troubled by the manner in which he behaved during that macabre encounter. Alan L. Berger. I have been teaching Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower, for many years. The issues remain seemingly intractable. Students are struck by the notion of forgiveness. Was Simon right? What about the meaning of his silence? Was Karl's repentance genuine? Further, if the Holocaust was unique, how can traditional responses, including forgiveness, be applied to monstrous evil? We are engaged at the most profound levels of meaning and response. In literary terms, silence is the principal character of this morality tale. And Simon was twice silent, once in the death chamber of a dying Nazi, and once in the presence of the dead man's mother. Are the silences the same? Do they convey different meaning? The first silence is one of confusion. Stunned, frightened, overwhelmed, Simon does not know which way to turn. He is torn between the ethical teachings of Judaism and the harsh reality of the Holocaust, whose only goal was the extermination of Jews. By way of contrast, the second silence is a conscious decision. It is taken out of kindness to the mother. What, it might be argued, would there be to gain by telling the mother the truth about her son? Preserving his memory was a true gift of grace, the only such gift to have a proper place in this story. To have forgiven her son would have been a desecration both of the memory of the Jewish victims and of the sanctity of forgiveness. In Simon's place, what would I do? This question raises a prior query. Am I entitled to forgive on behalf of the murdered? My response is, do not forgive someone for whom forgiveness is forbidden. Judaism teaches that there are two types of sins. One is that committed by humans against God, Ben Adam Lemakom. The second type consists of sin committed by humans against other humans, Ben Adam Leadam. I may forgive one who has sinned against me. I may not forgive one who has taken the life of another. My own thoughts are firm. Simon should and could not forgive on behalf of those so cruelly murdered. Further, in asking for a Jew to hear his confession, Karl perpetuated the Nazi stereotype. Jews were not individuals with souls, feelings, aspirations, and emotions. Rather, they were perceived as an amorphous, undifferentiated mass. Bring me a Jew, was the dying Nazi's request. Any Jew will do. Karl has learned nothing. His desire is to cleanse his own soul at the expense of the Jew. Was Karl's repentance sincere? Repentance in Hebrew comes from the word teshubah, meaning a turning away from evil, a turning toward Torah. It is a process rather than a single act. When it mattered, when he shot Jews jumping from a burning house, Karl displayed no moral courage. Recent studies have demonstrated that there were those who disobeyed orders, took a moral stance, and were not punished. It is far more difficult to act morally than immorally. Repentance is formulaic, a learned ritual which soothes the troubled soul of the murderer, but does nothing for those who were murdered. Is it morally possible to say, "I am sorry for the Holocaust," or to apologize for individual acts of murder whose great aggregate yielded the murder of millions of Jews? The entire issue of cheap grace, forgive and forget, is raised here. Presumably, Karl, achieving forgiveness, would go to heaven, whereas Simon and other Jews, including and especially the victims of the slaughter in the Polish town, would not. If the teachings of the Catholic Church were so radically deficient as to be unable to hold Karl to moral accountability, then shame on the Church, shame on the murderers, and shame on those who ask forgiveness, thereby requiring from others the moral integrity which they themselves so sorely lack. Let us assume for a moment that Karl either was not wounded or did not die. Would he then have had pangs of conscience? After the war, would he be among the penitents? Or would he not have been among those Nazis who either gathered to reminisce about the good old days, or simply resume his life, marrying, raising a family, prospering, and shaking his head over all the fuss Jews made over the Holocaust? A last reflection. Simon's Jewish conscience was deeply disturbed by the event. He spoke about it to his fellow prisoners, and clearly the matter still weighs heavily upon him. In reminding himself of the foul deeds of murder committed by the Nazis and the indifference to Jewish suffering displayed by the Poles, it seems as though Simon must present this evidence before the courtroom of his own conscience, which has become the scene of this titanic struggle. Is this not what Karl depended on? After all, Hitler blamed the Jews for bringing conscience to bear in history. Granting the murderer forgiveness would have been the final victory of Nazism. Had he spoken to Karl, Simon would have sealed his own guilt. Robert McAfee Brown, Warsaw, 1979. We are standing in front of the memorial to those Jews who lost their lives defending the Warsaw Ghetto. It is raining. A personal friend who survived that battle is giving an impassioned address. It is in Polish. Several days later, he gives me a copy of the translation. The passion carries over into English. The theme is clear. Never forget, never forgive. That we must never forget is perhaps the clearest lesson of the Holocaust. For if we forget, a time will come when even worse atrocities will be committed against Jews and any others whom those with power wish to destroy. That we must never forgive would seem to follow from the same stern logic. For if we forgive, it will be a sign to those in the future that they can act without fear of punishment, and that the universe has a moral escape valve labeled forgiveness that permits evil not only to survive, but to thrive. On this reading, forgiveness becomes a weak virtue, one that Christians seem particularly prone to champion, and one that always carries the possibility of condoning, rather than constricting, the spread of evil. And yet, I remain uneasy with the second conviction. Consider the absolutely worst-case scenario. It is in Auschwitz on a day when the gas chambers are falling behind their quotas. To accelerate the pace, children are lined up and thrown upon the open flames. Those toward the back of the line know full well that in a matter of moments the fate of those up front will be their fate as well, and there is nothing they can do about it. This strikes resonating chords with the scene Simon Wiesenthal has created for us, in which Jews of all ages are locked in a house that is then set on fire. Both episodes strain to the breaking point any contention that forgiveness would be appropriate within such circumstances. If God forgives such deeds, does not that likewise strain to the breaking point any contention that the universe of God's creation is a moral universe? A malevolent deity might be placed in charge of such arrangements, but surely not a God of mercy and compassion. And if God is not entitled to forgive, surely the same moral boundary is placed around God's children. To forgive the Nazis who threw children on the fire and locked them in houses to be incinerated is to become one with the Nazis, endorsing evil deeds rather than combating evil deeds, and thereby becoming complicit in their actions. Jews and Christians usually cope with the dilemma by affirming that God, rather than being removed from evil, is found in the midst of the evil, identifying with the victims rather than the perpetrators. So the Jewish imagery of the suffering servant in the book of Isaiah avers, and so the Christian imagery of Christ suffering on the cross likewise avers. But, as Elie Wiesel suggests in Ani Mamin, such a deliverance comes too late, 6 million deaths too late, and such a God seems powerless to be more than a remorseful deity who can endure but cannot enable. But perhaps there are situations where sacrificial love, with forgiveness at the heart of it, can make a difference and can even empower. One thinks of Nelson Mandela, released after 27 years in jail, patently entitled to wreak vengeance on his tormentors, who responds by forgiving his jailers. Or one thinks of Tomas Borga, a Nicaraguan Sandinista fighter, captured by the Contras and brutally tortured, confronting his torturer after the war had ended. The court entitled him to name the punishment appropriate for his torturer. Borga responded, "My punishment is to forgive you." Such instances build up a moral capital on which the rest of us can draw. Supposing, just supposing, that an act of forgiveness on our part could tip the scales toward compassion rather than brutality. We can propound these and other examples that might mitigate some of the harshness of the imperative never forgive, but in all instances we are exploring only exceptions to the rule. One cannot allow, as a human axiom, a position such as that of the philosopher-poet Heinrich Heine, "God will forgive, that's what he's here for." So, had I been in Simon Wiesenthal's position, fearful of denying too much or of promising too little, I think I would have urged the young man to address his plea directly to God and throw himself on the possibility of divine mercy, something I am not permitted to adjudicate one way or the other. How could I justify such a response, refusing to grant either sentimentalized mercy or hard-nosed judgment? I return to Elie Wiesel to offer two responses in the form of questions. 1. I do not believe we can supply an answer to the first question, "Where is God in all this?" a question on the lips of character after character in Wiesel's novels. The closer I come to what might be called an answer, the more circumspect I must become, although I must keep trying to do so. I will always come up short. 2. What we can do on the far side of such an impasse is to respond to another question and truly make it our own. In Wiesel's The Gates of the Forest, a Rebbe, confronted with evil and God's transparent involvement in it, asks out of deep anguish, "What is there left for us to do?" This is what we must exhume from the debris of our inadequate answers. What answers there are will finally come not from the region of our minds, but from the precincts of our hearts. It will be in doing, rather than in speculating, that we will learn whatever it is permitted us to learn. What is there left for us to do? Only everything from doing justly, loving kindness, and walking humbly with God, to standing with the victims and the oppressed. And if we do so, perhaps, just perhaps, a world will begin to emerge in which we do not have to ask unanswerable questions any longer.